Derrida Fritz made a couple of major mistakes. His first mistake was to reconfigure his machinery to exactly the same start position of the first message, a procedure incidentally totally forbidden within the laws of cryptology. He then reprocessed the whole of that message and eventually got bundled up, sent over the airwaves in the form of high-speed electrical impulses, and of course was duly intercepted, monitored and recorded. And the experts noted the second message started off exactly the same as the first, suddenly changed format, kept running and got signed off. So they compared the two messages. They found the first message was 4,000 characters long, but the second message only 3,500 characters long. But hold on, it had to be the same message. So what had he done? He'd obviously abbreviated. The challenge was given to John Tiltman, who I mentioned earlier. He put pen to paper and tested various propositions, and eventually established that the first time round, the operator had used the word Spruchnummer in full, but the second time round, Spruch-NR. By the simple abbreviation of the language equivalent of message number, he was able to break the whole of that encipherment. Having completed that exercise, another expert was brought to play, a scientist, a man called Bill Tutt. And the challenge given to him was to design on paper the cipher machine in question. Having completed that exercise, all the heads of department came together again, because the next challenge was to design and build a machine to crack said encipherment. And eventually, with the help of the telecommunications research establishment at Malvern, a machine was built, and it was called a Robinson after Heath Robinson. The traffic in question represented an encipherment, what we call the Bodo Convention. The teleprinter system communicated electronically over the airwaves. So the experts were able to convert the high-speed electrical impulses back into the five-hole paper message tape used in teleprinters and telex. The message tape was put into the Robinson, counter-read against what they call a checking tape, and the cross-readings related with various items within the Robinson. And the crazy thing is, the machine worked. Having had the good news, the bad news. It took 6 weeks to crack a message, which meant any resultant intelligence was totally obsolete. So, back to the drawing boards. Well, cutting a long story short, a brilliant young engineer was introduced who horrified the establishment with his solution of a new machine. He kept the message tape. He got rid of the checking tape. He introduced a magic eye and a photocell reading system, and then, as he put it, to save time, he replaced all the functions of the Robinson by valves, on the theory that valves do their work in microseconds and time was of the essence. But go back to the era. In fact, if you go to Hut 1, just by the tennis courts there, look at the old-fashioned wartime radios. What were wirelesses full of, in fact, in those days? Valves. And every time you turned a wireless on, there was every little valve going bing. And if you didn't buy a new valve, no music. He allayed their fears by saying, don't worry, when we build this machine, we'll treat it very, very carefully. But above all, when we switch it on, we'll power it up very, 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 very gently. And when it gets to full power, we'll never turn it off. Which means then the valves are not subject to high-speed electrical impulses, which might cause them to break. A machine was built. It had 1,500 valves, was delivered to Bletchley Park in December 43, commissioned in January 44, and joy of joy, it worked. As a consequence, further machines were ordered. In fact, a further 9 were subsequently delivered and installed, but each of the Mark IIs had 2,500 valves each. And the first of those machines came online on the 1st of June 1944, just in time for D-Day. At the end of the war, as part of the suppression of activities here, these machines had to go. But unlike the rest, which got destroyed, etc., etc., these weren't. They were pulled apart, unscrewed, items separated, laid out on racks. Why? Waste not, want not. The engineer who designed the machine worked for the post office. His name was Tommy Flowers, working at their experimental station at Dollis Hill in North London. He'd used standard GPO components, everything you'd find in a telephone exchange. So the items got distributed up and down the country as spare parts. There were 2 further machines, however, which had been delivered but not installed here, taken away by GCHQ, used for purposes totally undeclared, and finally destroyed in 1961 with all pertaining documentation. Now let's go forward in time. In the early 90s, a group of Americans very proudly announced that in the forthcoming future, they proposed to celebrate the 50th anniversary of a machine called the ENIAC, a machine which they calculated to be the first programmable computer in the world. Tony Sale of Bletchley Park said about rebuilding one of the wartime machines, and in fact he got switched on in its Mark I format, 1,500 valves, on the 1st of June 1996 by the Duke of Kent. Today that machine is its Mark II format, 2,500 valves. And for the last 18 months, Tony Sale and his team have managed to crack a fully enciphered tape for the first time since 1945. The machine we call the Colossus is now recognized worldwide as the first programmable computer in the world, albeit switch programmed and no stored memory. And the Americans ain't half pissed off. So I think the best thing is we go and see it, and I'll explain its functions. So if you'd like to come this way, please.